you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have Dr. E. Michael Jones back on the show. Dr. Jones is a historian, prolific writer, and editor of Culture Wars magazine. Among his many books are The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit and Its Impact on World History, Barren Metal, A History of Capitalism as a Conflict Between Labor and Usury, and the most recent, The Broken Pump in Tanzania, Julius Nyerere and the Collapse of Development Economics. His most recent book, it was an e-book, it was a long article he wrote for Culture Wars magazine, expanded into an e-book. It's entitled How Mario Lansky Took Over the Cincinnati Ballet and What Four Ballerinas Did About It. I read it. It's not as long as your usual books, but it's packed full of information. It was a great read, very thought-provoking, very insightful. It's about, it's ballet and Cincinnati, but so much more, the culture wars. So, Dr. Jones, how are you doing this evening?
Good.
Thank you for coming back on. You're certainly welcome. And, this book, The Cincinnati Ballet. So, what made you decide to write about it, and what is it all about?
Well, my son was a dancer at the Cincinnati Ballet. He started there about 7 years ago. He met a young lady there, and they fell in love and they got married. She was a ballerina at the same ballet company. And this summer, this spring, the last performance we went to was the modern dance performance, Kaplan New Works, modern dance, through which I have suffered for 10 years, or 7, 8 years. It's always the same thing. It's always the sex robot dance. That's what modern dance is. It's always about how my relationship with my boyfriend really sucks, and I don't understand why. But this year, something unusual happened. And just to show you that I'm not the only guy who thinks something unusual happened, Cincinnati Enquirer, an article about 40% of the dancers are leaving the Cincinnati Ballet. That's a lot of dancers. The other start part that they didn't really talk about, but which got picked up by the Ballerina Mothers Association, is that four of the ballerinas got pregnant. This is a, I think this must be a world record for a ballet. I never heard of this, that four of the ballerinas would get pregnant all at the same time. What I think the Cincinnati Inquirer missed, I mean, far be it from me to criticize other journalists, but what I think they missed was that there's a protest going on here. You don't lose 40% of the people in your organization just by chance. You maybe use one or two, but you don't lose 40%. And you don't have suddenly, and the inability to understand the protest, I think, also can be found in the fact that the Cincinnati Inquirer article didn't mention the four pregnant ballerinas. There's a connection there.
Yeah, I noticed when you said the article, I was missing from that article. I read it.
Yeah, something missing because they don't have the hermeneutical skills or tools to understand what's going on. And to understand what's going on, you have to go back to the Kaplan New Works again. And the whole turn that classical or modern dance has taken over the past half century or so. What is modern dance? It began with Isadora Duncan, who was the America's most famous dancer next to Little Egypt, who was the most famous dancer in America as of the Chicago exhibition of 1894. It developed with Isadora Duncan and Martha Graham with this kind of emotive feminism. It's like, I'm this, I'm the woman at the center of the universe. I want to tell you about what's really on my mind. One of the people that danced with in Martha Graham's group was a guy by the name of Merce Cunningham. If you type in the Martha Graham and the Appalachian Spring, the ballet for which Aaron Copland wrote the music, you can see Merce Cunningham standing there looking like a fifth wheel. Merce Cunningham was a homosexual. You put the two of them together and you have modern dance, basically emotive feminism, motive exhibitionistic feminism, and homosexual alienation. You put those two things together and you have what I've called the sex robot dance, where everybody goes through these mechanical motions and relationships always fail. That's the message of modern dance. Relationships are doomed. This is the dance is about relationships. That's all it is. It's male, female. They're coming together. In ballet, classical ballet, you got a 50-50 chance that you're going to have a happy ending. In modern dance, there's no possibility of a happy ending. It's always the relationship fails. What I'm saying here is that this was a protest against modern dance in general. It was a protest against the leadership of Victoria Morgan, who now has taken the ballet to new depths by turning it into some type of feminist propaganda machine. Victoria Morgan reinvented herself as the ballerina boss. And as the ballerina boss, check it out on YouTube, look up her video. She says she's going to showcase women in ballet.
Okay.
Well, that's a little bit like showcasing black people in the NBA, you know? Not something that's really an urgent need in either case, you know? So what is she talking about? Well, she's talking about the ugly social engineering rearing its ugly head in probably one of the last bastions where women can be women and men can be men. Women have been forced into a situation where basically they're all trying out for the WNBA. Why would anyone in his right mind want to watch women do something that men can do better? That's what the WNBA is, but that's not what ballet is. But you've got this overlay of, what should I say, social engineering that is becoming just intolerable. What is the issue right now? What is the issue if you're 20 years old? The issue is still sexual liberation is a form of political control. That's what it is now. That's what it's always been. But at this moment in time, the cutting edge of sexual liberation is homosexuality. And the homosexual has become our ideal citizen. And so what you had here at the ballet was this kind of overlay of social engineering, of feminism, of homosexual ideology, and nobody likes it. Everybody hates it. But, you know, ballerinas, dancers are not known for being articulate, are they? If there's ever a world where actions speak louder than words, it's the ballet. So you can't expect these people to articulate what the problem is. They can't do it. That's why they're dancers. And so they had to have a protest, a kind of inchoate protest, and they left. Some of them got pregnant and left, but a lot of people just left. They couldn't take it anymore. What is the issue here? It's homosexuality. It's the destruction of gender identity. It's this destruction of male and female. They're all being dragooned into something that they don't want to. They don't believe in, but they don't know how to object to it. What's the position that you're in when you're a 20-year-old now? In your 20s, you're just getting started. This is the moment when relationships are the most important thing in your life, because it's the beginning of the rest of your life. I look back 50 years ago, mm-hmm. when I was that age, and I thought, you know, the relationship is the most important thing. I made the decision, and I've been married to that woman for 48 years now. Mm-hmm. All of these young people are in that situation, and they're all being put into a – and they're all being told – they're all being given the wrong instructions. They're all being told you need to act like a homosexual even if you're not a homosexual. You have to behave like a homosexual because the homosexual is the ideal citizen. Why is that? Well, because they're docile narcissists who are easy to control. That's the oligarch view of the homosexual. And they like to cloak it in rights talk, but that's basically the bottom line. They're narcissistic, they've got problems, and they're easy to manipulate. So what you're supposed to do, even if you're not a homosexual, you're supposed to act like a homosexual. How do you act like a homosexual when you're not? Well, you engage in transient, sterile relationships. That's what you're supposed to do. And they keep you preoccupied and distracted from the fact that you're not earning a decent wage, that all you can get is an unpaid internship, that you're living in your parents' basement, that your life sucks. But at least you're free according to the oligarch's determination of freedom. This is the situation that my son and my daughter-in-law found themselves in, and they rejected it. They rejected it. They decided they're going to form a permanent relationship. They got married, and not only did they got married at Old St. Mary's Church, which you probably know since you're from Cincinnati. Beautiful church in Over the Rhine. Mm-hmm. This was an affront to everything that the art world stands for, and this book is about how we got to that situation.
Yeah, your interesting insights about ballet being, because it's female, as George Balanchine said. You quote George Balanchine: ballet is female, but there's no confusing the sex roles in ballet.
No, absolutely not.
Yeah, and the application of modern dance to ballet is to one yet another attempt to in the culture war to destroy those differences.
No, classical ballet is based on sexual difference. Mm-hmm. The only men who wear pink tutus are NFL football players, as a joke. everything is dramatically polarized in terms of sexual roles in the ballet. And I think this is why the ballet has been targeted by the cultural mavens who want to obliterate all distinctions. Because they want to destroy nature. They are at war with nature. They are at war with Logos. What is the group that is at war with Logos? We've talked about this before.
Oh, it's not the Baptist, is it? No, but
It's not the Samoans. Come on. You got two more guesses.
Well, as a group, yeah, I would say the organized Jewish community. Let's just put it that way, yes.
We've talked about this before. Yeah. You know, their war with Logos began at the foot of the cross. There is a Logos to all of existence, because all of existence was created by God, who is the Logos. As St. John's Gospel says, first sentence, in the beginning there was the Logos, and the third sentence is, and Logos was God. God and Logos are interchangeable. We were born into a world that is radically ordered. And there's a group of people who you just named who, when their Messiah came, they chose not unanimously, but the Jewish people chose to kill him, murdered him. And they said, his blood be on us and our children. That was a horrible thing to do. And these people have perdured in that horrible decision to this day. If you don't believe me, ask Sarah Silverman. She's supposed to be a comedian. I don't know what there's so funny about her, but she recently said that, yeah, we killed Christ and I'd do it again. That's the type of animus that you're dealing with here. This is a radical hatred of Logos.
So she's embracing the blood libel.
That's right. That's exactly it. I mean, you think this was, you know, this is a if she didn't exist, Hitler would have to invent her. This is the type of people that we're talking about. Now they're being passed off as comedians. Hey, they're not funny anymore. I don't know when the Jews stopped being funny, but Sarah Silverman is not funny. So of course they get into everything, and of course I have to get into everything as well, and that means the history of Cincinnati as the one of the great battlefields of the culture wars in the United States of America.
Yeah, why is Cincinnati such a great battleground? That's very interesting to me. The Midwest, because this plays into America First Committee. This was an area a lot of German ethnics.
Absolutely.
You know, so the Catholic influence in Cincinnati is immense.
Yeah, it was a Catholic. It was a German Catholic city. And it was known as conservative, and that put it on the radar. Okay, but as I say in the book, it goes back before that time. It's a tale of two cities, as I said in the book. There's Cincinnati, there's the Ohio River, and there's Newport, Kentucky. Mm-hmm. And the people in Cincinnati created Newport as Sin City, or preserved it as Sin City. They didn't want any of this vice. And by vice, I mean gambling, prostitution, and during Prohibition, alcohol. They didn't want it in Cincinnati. They put it across the river, and you had to cross the river to engage in those type of activities.
I mean, that's so funny, because I remember just as a kid hearing my dad reference going, you go to Kentucky for that stuff. And of course, that's where Jerry Springer got in trouble, right?
Yeah.
He was as a councilman or something. He paid for the services of a prostitute in a Kentucky bordello.
Yeah.
It's very funny. It's
part of the history of Cincinnati. Yeah, this is the way of dealing with vice. So push it across the Ohio River. Okay. Eventually, so the best thing that ever happened to crime here was Prohibition. At this point, we have a group of Jewish mobsters from Cleveland who came to be known as the Jewish Navy. Jewish Navy would ferry alcohol from the Bronfman Distillery across Lake Erie or across the Detroit River, and then they distribute it across the United States. And they found that Newport, Kentucky had a lot of thirsty people. They could really turn over a lot of booze in Newport, Kentucky. So Mo Dalitz, one of the Jewish mobsters, showed up in Newport, Kentucky. He took over a casino, made Dutch Schultz an offer he couldn't refuse, burned down his racetrack, and then killed him. Now, he took over one of the casinos, and everything was going fine, except Roosevelt had to ruin the whole game by legalizing booze. At this point, the casino had to retool, and they turned their speakeasies into casinos. And so you still have prostitution, but now it was gambling and prostitution as opposed to gambling, alcohol, and prostitution, or illegal. So the reputation, spread, and, the world's changing. Everybody's got a car after World War II. You can drive to a place like this. It became a regional vice center. And one of the people there, a guy by the name of George Ratterman, Notre Dame quarterback, Catholic guy, 8 kids, decides to run for sheriff. And at this point, he gets an invitation to one of the casinos. An Italian guy who was a front man for the Jews at the casino invites him to dinner. George reaches for a scotch, takes a sip of the scotch. Next thing he knows, he's lying naked in bed with a stripper by the name of April Flowers. April worked at one of these casinos, and the photographer shows up. It's like the front page, the front page of L.A. Confidential. The door gets kicked in, the flashbulb goes off, and the cops come in and they arrest George Ratterman. And this looks like the end of his campaign to become sheriff of Newport, Kentucky, and clean up the town. His wife, fortunately, had the presence of mind to take him to their family physician the next day, and he did a blood test, and he found George had enough chloral hydrate in his system to kill an entire football team. So the whole attempt to drive ruin George Ratterman backfired. He gets elected in a landslide. And not only that, he comes to the attention of Robert and John Kennedy, who are avid football fans. They remember George from Notre Dame playing for the Cleveland Browns. And now Bobby Kennedy sends the FBI down to Newport, Kentucky, and they drive the Jews out of Newport, Kentucky, never to return. Mo Dalitz goes to Las Vegas.
Ah, yes, yes. Makes it big.
Meyer Lansky got out of Newport as well. Meyer Lansky had been in Las Vegas. Because he sent Bugsy Siegel to build the casino, the Flamingo, in Las Vegas, and Bugsy didn't do it to Meyer's liking, so Meyer had him rubbed out, as we say in gangster speak. And Mo Dalitz went and took Bugsy's place, and he became legit. He went legit in Las Vegas. Now, how do you do this?
Oh, you become a philanthropist, right?
How do you become legit when you're a Jewish mobster? Yes, you become a philanthropist, you start giving away money, but if you're a Jewish mobster, the best thing you can do is give money to the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, which is exactly what Mo Dalitz did. Actually, Meyer Lansky did too, but they couldn't save Meyer Lansky. So now anybody who calls Mo Dalitz a mobster is an anti-Semite.
Mm-hmm.
And just to make the transformation, Mo must have given him a lot of money. I don't have the stubs of his checkbook, but you know he gave him a lot of money because in 1984, the ADL gave this Jewish mobster its Torch of Liberty Award. Joan Rivers handed over the award. So what are we talking? We're talking about corruption on a massive scale.
Mm-hmm.
Because what used to be criminal activity is now the basis of philanthropy. And in a sense, what should we be surprised that we have the political system that we have now? Who's the heir of Mo Dalitz and Meyer Lansky?
Sheldon Adelson.
Sheldon Adelson, yeah, that's right. who basically buys the Republican nominee, at least up until the time of Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
So this is in a sense what has happened to our culture. Basically, you had the Jews taking it over through criminal activity, which then got turned into legit activity because they bribed politicians. That's what happened. And the enormous amount of money they have, and Sheldon Adelson's a classic example of it, now buys politicians in our day. And so the net result is that infamous moment in American history when Benjamin Netanyahu addresses the American Congress and he gets 27 standing ovations from those boot-licking lackeys who are out there to get IPAC money. Now, I say that. Everybody calls me an anti-Semite when I say that. But the New York Times wrote the same article. They wrote it in an article. They said the only reason these people were jumping up and down on cue is because IPAC, the American Israel Political Action Committee, had its people there, and they were taking notes. And if you didn't jump up and cheer, you were cut out of Jewish money. This is what has ruined our Congress, and Cincinnati played a big role in this whole operation.
Yeah, that either you're blackmailed or you're bribed or both, and between both those strategies, they can get a strong majority in Congress on their side.
That's right. Yeah. And guess who the major black? So yes, the ADL is a blackmailing organization. That's right. It's an intelligence organization. And guess who one of the main people was that they were blackmailing?
Mr. FBI himself, right?
Mr. FBI himself, J. Edgar Hoover, who has his own checkered past now, doesn't he? Speaking of the homosexualization of American culture, J. Edgar Hoover could never break the bad habit he had of going to the ADL for blackmail information. And they had their information on him. And this unholy alliance reached its culmination in 85 when William Webster, Hoover's successor as the head of the FBI, announces an alliance with the ADL, the same mob-funded operation that sanitized Modalitz, that the FBI was spent 50 years trying to put Modalitz behind jail, and they failed, probably because of the interference of J. Edgar Hoover. And then finally in 85, they throw up their hands and say, okay, we're in bed with the criminals. We're in bed with the ADL. The ADL gets its money from Jewish mobsters. We're in bed with the criminals. And once you're in bed with the criminals, guess what? You go after normal citizens that Jews don't like. And that was the whole story of hate crimes and the FBI's involvement in going after hate crimes. But there was the crucial transformation took place in the world of art, to get back to ballet, which is the art form. And Cincinnati played a crucial role in that.
And here, of course, this is the battleground for these various obscenity cases. I mean, Larry Flint's from Ohio.
Wait a minute. Don't badmouth Ohio. Larry Flint is from Kentucky.
Oh, I'm sorry. He was active in Ohio. That's right. Yeah.
You're not new about the difference between Ohio and Kentucky.
Yeah. but
Flint is from Kentucky.
But he came across and tried to open a bunch of, porno shops.
A deliberate provocation. A deliberately tried to provoke Cincinnati, because Cincinnati had the reputation of being conservative. And he knew which side his bread was buttered on. He knew that the Supreme Court was, and the people who control, the oligarchs who control the culture, wanted to promote obscenity, wanted to promote it. Because they know it's of control.
Yeah, they use the excuse.
The ADL, by the way, also.
They use the excuse of free expression or free speech. Isn't that the Roth
decision?
Of course,
they always do that, don't they? They always do that. So when Bobby Kennedy went after Ralph Ginsburg for an obscenity trial for the publication of the magazine Eros, the defense lawyers could get people like Norman Mailer, some Jew, some professor, come in and say, yeah, it's art. It's art. And nobody knew what to say, because the Jews had already taken over the art world, and basically the art world had been turned upside down. Mm-hmm. It's modern art, isn't it? Isn't it called modern art? As I bring out in this book, the CIA got involved in modern art in 1947.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they were doing shows for Jackson Pollock, Jack the Dripper, as Time magazine called him.
Didn't one of his pictures hung upside down on the...
Well, nobody knew. That's the whole point of modern art, isn't it? You can't tell whether it's hung upside down or not.
That is the point of modern art, isn't it?
It is the point of modern art. You're supposed to stand there and think, I don't understand this at all. It's deliberately there to befuddle you.
Yeah, the universe is just chaos. Exactly, yeah.
It's chaos. There's no logos here. And so, but it's rich people supporting it. So therefore, you're not rich. So they must know something you don't know, right?
Yes.
You must be stupid. It must be you. It's like the classic instance of the Emperor's New Clothes.
Mm-hmm. And this was you mentioned the CIA, because that was the Congress of Cultural Freedom. Frank Wisner, I think, operated that. But that was like a bunch of publication magazine, art, promoting art, marshaling the intellectuals and artists of the West against the Soviet Union, supposedly. But really the target was the West, as it turns out, as so was so much of the Cold War was. It was a psychological warfare targeting us, the American people. Strategy of tension. The obscenities, these obscenity cases under the cover of art or free expression, this destroys the police powers of local authorities to maintain decency. This is all part of an oligarch's plan, sort of a globalist plan to destroy community standards, which is, you know.
That's right. Yeah. Communities, anything that has any type of logos has the potential of providing resistance to the oligarchs and their schemes, which is basically to extract your labor at the lowest possible price.
One thing, it's you mentioned, you know, of course, this guy, George Roderman, this Notre Dame football player running for sheriff, who eventually wins despite the scandal is exposed as a setup. That's very similar to what happens in Godfather 2 with Senator Geary and the Corleones in Las Vegas. But that's a reflection of reality that happens a lot in politics. You compromise somebody. And that's why, you know, these various sex scandals and intelligence operations are involved in human trafficking and these things, because it's a source of intelligence to control the political process, to sort of blunt any meaningful oversight of their operations. Of course, the Israeli intelligence is big into that too, the Mossad. But
The Stasi was big into it too. I stayed in Berlin, mm-hmm. in East, what used to be called East Berlin, and there was the International Hotel. The whores would stand outside there. The diplomats would pick them up, take them up to a room, and then everything was on camera. Every room had a camera in it, so that you could bug them and then, you know, use it as blackmail.
Yeah,
it's classic.
Classic. Well, one thing that's interesting is George Roderman, because he's a Catholic from Notre Dame. He's now running for sheriff, 1960 in Newport, Kentucky. That it catches the attention of the Kennedys, Bobby and John F. Kennedy, because they're Catholic, of course.
Yeah.
What it goes to show is the importance of a ethno-religious, particularly a Catholic identity in America, as sort of a check on whether it's the WASP elite or the Jewish organized Jewish community, how the destruction of that Catholic identity was so targeted in the middle part of the 20th century, wouldn't you say, is why it was targeted?
Yeah, and you're talking about the Second Vatican Council,
mm-hmm.
where the Jews were heavily involved in subverting the Second Vatican Council. They used their agent was Father Malachy Martin, the Jesuit. I document this in the Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, mm-hmm. the whole mm-hmm. story of that attempt. They failed. Okay, the Church Fathers did not exonerate the Jews from deicide. They said the statement, their Irenic statement in Nostra Aetate is not all Jews at the time of Christ were responsible for his death. Well, I can imagine the bishops laughing up their sleeves. Did anyone ever say that the Blessed Mother cried out, crucify him?
Yes, yes. It's obvious. Yeah.
That St. John, the beloved disciple, was shaking his fist at Jesus? No, obviously not. Obviously not. It was the Jewish people who killed Jesus Christ. That doesn't mean every Jew, okay? A large number of the Jews accepted Jesus Christ as their Messiah, and they are known as Catholics.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they became. They're Christians. They're Catholics. They became the basis of the church. The group that called for his death are known as Jews now, and they have perdured in their rebellion against Logos to this day. Ask Sarah Silverman.
Mm-hmm.
And don't take my word for it.
This is a key moment, a crisis, you'd say, because this is the end of Mosaic Judaism or Biblical Judaism and the beginning of Talmudic Judaism, right?
That's right. So yeah. Judaism is younger than Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
It was created, centuries later with the codification of the Babylonian Talmud, which was about 500 years after Christ.
Yeah.
And so it's a much younger religion. It's an anti-religion. A symbolic expression of what I'm talking about is Hanukkah. Hanukkah is it's totally bogus. It makes Kwanzaa look legitimate. Kwanzaa is basically Black Hanukkah. What am I talking about? It's an artificially created celebration to distract you from Jesus Christ, the Savior of all mankind. That's what we're talking about here, okay? And what you have here is this constant agitation. This constant restlessness to undermine the social order, because suddenly, you know, it's not going in our favor. Whatever it is, I'll let other people delve into the psychology here. But this is what was driving the situation in Cincinnati as well. So a group of ladies get together and they want to start a modern art gallery or academy. And so they go to, who do they go to?
Well, yeah, I guess they go to probably a Jewish-run foundation or an old.
Who is the big banking family? Kub, Kuhn-Loeb, I forget the guy's name.
Oh, Kuhn-Loeb, Schiff?
Yeah, what's the guy?
Warburg?
Warburg. That's
well, right. The Warburg family. Oh, yeah, the Warburg family. Yeah.
So, whatever the Warburg I'm talking about, it's in the book.
Edward, I think it's Edward Warburg.
His mother is the daughter of Jacob Schiff. Jacob Schiff is the guy who gave Trotsky the money to murder the Tsar and overthrow the Russian government. So he comes by it naturally. So at this point in America, the state of the art revolution is modern art. And so they start the Contemporary Art Center, and they're beginning the infiltration, the undermining of Cincinnati culture,
mm-hmm.
through the arts. And let's be honest, in the 1930s, what they were doing seems completely benign now. Why did anybody ever get upset about it? Who cares if you don't know whether the picture's hanging right side up or upside down?
Mm-hmm.
Being such a Philistine, you know, it's modern. Well, things never stay the same, do they? Do they? And that whole, so when the Black Jewish Alliance collapsed and they couldn't get Negroes to rise up in the South and overthrow murdered white people, the Jews turned to the homosexual. 1969, we have the Stonewall riots. 1972, the Jews collaborate and get the homosexuality taken out of the DSM, which is the list of psychiatric disorders. At this point, the fix is in, okay? And if you're a young, ambitious Catholic guy who wants to make it in the art world, you know what's going on. And so we have a young, just the type of guy I'm talking about, he's 2 years older than me. His name is Robert Mapplethorpe, Catholic altar boy from Floral Park, New York, who, you know, had a bad relationship with his father, and that's the cause of homosexuality. And so he's struggling, you know. But the world is the art world, especially in New York City, which is the center of the art world after World War II. They're promoting this. He knows what's going on, and so he succumbs, and he starts taking pictures of his own degradation. So now we're not talking about – now you know whether it's hanging upside down or right side up.
Although, maybe.
I guess that's a step in the right direction. So we have a picture. I hope no one's offended, but Robert Mapplethorpe with a bullwhip sticking out of his ass.
Yeah.
Picture him. That's the famous picture in this exhibition. I'm sorry if I offended anyone. But that's what's being pushed on Cincinnati. Mapplethorpe dies. He made a pact with the devil. Patti Smith was his girlfriend. She made very clear. He made very clear. He made a pact with the devil. Be careful when you make a pact with the devil. Make sure you have all the bases covered in this pact, okay? Because he asked for success, and the devil gave him what he wanted, but he forgot to ask for health so he could savor his success. So he reaches the pinnacle of success, and he dies of AIDS. And at this point, the Jewish art vultures come in, and they make a killing off of Robert Mapplethorpe. And the NEA gets involved. And this was one of the biggest battles in the culture wars in my lifetime, your lifetime.
Yeah,
I don't know whether you
remember. I remember very well, 89, 90, yeah.
Yeah, 92, Pat Buchanan, the Catholic mm-hmm. guy, shocks the conservative world by basically resurrecting America first. And at this point, he also attacks the NEA. John Frohnmayer had given federal money to the Mapplethorpe exhibit, you know, there he is with the bullwhip. And it's being, the photos are being passed around Congress. And Robert Byrd says, we funded that? Yes, you did. And George H.W. was in charge. He tried to defend Frohnmayer, and then Buchanan won the New Hampshire election primary. And at that point, he threw Frohnmayer under the bus. But it was too late. He was doomed because the Jews didn't like him. So the exhibition is now traveling around, and it ends up in Cincinnati. Why is it in Cincinnati? Because they were itching for an obscenity trial.
Mm-hmm.
So the trial comes, and basically it's all of the same Jewish blah, 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 just like Norman Mailer, except it's some professor, and he's saying, yeah, it's art this, and you load us the forms. Well, it has to be the bullwhip sticking out of his ass. But let's not talk about that part of it. You know, it's like the Wizard of Oz. Don't pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. Let's just talk about form, blah, blah, blah. So eventually they had the jury so befuddled that they acquitted the Contemporary Art Center, who has been rewarded now. They have a huge building now paid for by some rich Jew.
Yeah, because classical art, you know, it's art. Anyone can walk in and admire it and acknowledge its form. You know, there's various similitude, there's standards, there's symmetry, all these things. It reflects reality. It has to have some resonance with you because it's a reflection of reality at the very least. But this is just off the wall, so you can make some sort of cockamamie argument.
No, it's deliberately transgressive.
Yeah,
because the Jews hate logos, and so it's both pornographic and blasphemous.
Mm-hmm.
They're the twin pillars of Jewish art. Love to support both of those things.
Yeah, you have the foreman of the juror who operates some typical guy, wage earner, family guy probably, and warehouse manager. You have his quote saying, well, I know it's obscene, but they tell me it's art, so I don't know art, so it's got to be art.
That's right. So you see. All this has come to fruition here. The seed that Warburg planted in Cincinnati in the 1930s has come to fruition. Nobody can make any judgments anymore. There's no local culture. There's no local discernment. It's just whatever experts tell us to do, I have to do it. So that's what the trial, 25 years after the trial, they have a retrospective exhibition, and then they let the cat out of the bag. Now there's a guy who says, well, it was really about destroying the political power of the Catholics in Cincinnati. Oh, so now you tell us. So now it's 25 years later. So now we get to the real heart of the story. That's what was going on. It was ethnic warfare. It was Jews versus Catholics. You know, so all of this stuff about Nostra Aetate, all of this stuff about Catholic-Jewish dialogue, there are elder brothers, blah, blah, blah. It's all just phony. They're kicking you under the table, you know, and they're trying to talk about being your friend, you know. No, no, no. It's the same cultural warfare that's been going on ever since Annas and Caiaphas stood at the foot of the cross.
And it seems Nothing to be the playbook out of Herbert Marcuse and also the authoritarian personality, too.
Guess who the authoritarian personality was? It was Catholics.
Mm-hmm.
It was Jews objecting to Catholics upholding the moral order. That's what that was all about. And the AJC paid for the book, and they paid for all these Jews to come over and write the book for them.
Yeah, and more or less declare ethnic warfare on Christians, particularly Catholics. But you know,
that's
to,
right.
To weaken
that's
the family right. through sexualization.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. That's what happened. And this is my son Sam is born when the Mapplethorpe Contemporary Art Center exhibit gets acquitted. He's born basically within a month of that acquittal. And he ends up in Cincinnati. Now, what is anybody supposed to know? A 20-year-old something shows up in Cincinnati. How's he supposed to know any of this type of stuff?
Yeah, yeah.
You can't know this type of stuff. You're thrown into the world, and there are rules in place, and you don't know how they got there. And the rules in place are basically, you may not be a homosexual, but you better act like one, which means transient, sterile relationships until your contract doesn't get renewed. And then it's bye-bye, honey. Now, what type of life is this to lead? This is the rankest type of exploitation I can imagine. And the only question is, why did it take all of these dancers so long to wake up to the fact? In my humble opinion, the thing that woke them up to the fact was the fact that Sam and Courtney got married at Old St. Mary's Church. And they did. This was a protest against transient, sterile relationships. Victoria Morgan was invited to that wedding, and she did not come. And I said in the book, it reminded me of Sleeping Beauty. It's not. Carabas is one of the fairies. She does not get invited to the christening. And she shows up anyway, and she puts a curse on the baby. And the lilac fairy steps in. It's one of the greatest moments in ballet when the lilac fairy holds up her hand against Carabas and deflects the curse. Just a great moment. Well, this is what happened to Sam. He got fired right after they got married. I said, this is an assault on their relationship. I'm sorry. Actions speak louder than words. It's an assault on their relationship by the ballerina boss who was playing the role of Carabas here. And I told Sam what had happened. Good will come of this. And I was right. So listen to your father. The first good that came of it is my granddaughter, Gwen. And the second good that came of it was this consciousness that spread throughout the ballet. And three other human beings now exist who would not have been in existence had this not happened. So it's a classic example of how God takes evil and turns it into good.
This is the cunning of reason?
Cunning of reason. Hegel would be proud. Hegel would love this story.
And you also you use that French Quebec quote, which is revenge of the cradle, right?
The revenge of the cradle. And I also use Sigmund Freud, the return of the repressed.
Yes.
Because nature will out. That's the message here. And you can't go against nature no matter how much money you have. Ultimately, you're going to lose. And I think that's the story here. That's the moral of the story.
And you talk a lot, you talked about Robert Mapplethorpe, where he sort of made his pact with the devil. For commercial success, for worldly success. But of course, then his health failed on him because of his lifestyle. And you talk about AIDS a little bit, sort of the AIDS scam, and how this links back to this lady Matilda Krim, who was an Ugu.
Yeah, Matilda Krim.
That's an interesting story because it just that you want to talk about exploitation. First, you're exploiting him, the artist. He's exploited sexually so he can have success by these art dealers in New York City. But he makes that deal himself, and then because of that, he suffers his health problem and ultimately dies from his lifestyle. But then they're there to reap the rewards of the increased value of his art. At the same time, the art community itself is sort of this insider trading deal where these art dealers where they'll control the idea of what art is. That'll run the value up and they'll make more money off it.
That's right. That's what happened after World War II with abstract expressionism. Basically, no one can tell what it is, whether it's good, bad, or indifferent. So that means that the art dealer has the upper hand now in every transaction, and art becomes insider trading.
Yeah.
So basically, you got money, you show up at the gallery, the guy says, look, I know you can't tell whether it's hanging right side up or upside down. That doesn't matter. Basically, if you invest in this now, you will get a certain X return on your investment. And in a sense, it's true because it's like a stock. It's like buying a stock. The more people who buy it, the more the price goes up. And so it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's just that the Jewish middleman makes all the money and the artist is sort of frozen out. The artist is a creation now of the Jewish middleman.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's face it, nobody, you're looking at, you can't tell, is this the next Michelangelo? I don't know. Is it hanging upside down or right side up? I can't tell. You know, he's got all the power and they took over the art world and Mapplethorpe is in this situation. Now, the irony here is that Matilda Krim comes to power after the death of John Kennedy. Now, I know you believe that John F. Kennedy was murdered by a lone deranged gunman because having been in the intelligence community, I'm sure that story was told over and over and over again. I don't know why you're laughing. This is serious business here. There are some people who feel that Lyndon Johnson may have had something to do with it. And what happened with Lyndon Johnson was that the world changed dramatically. And suddenly the Jews who were going to be, Kennedy was going to prevent them from getting nuclear weapons. Suddenly they've got nuclear weapons. And Johnson is basically their pawn. And that he has set the role, the form for what has followed ever since. The lady who's responsible for this was Matilda Krim. She was this cute little Swiss chick blonde hair, and he fell for her, and she was his mistress. Her second husband was a Hollywood movie mogul who built a house there so that Lyndon and she could snuggle together, as they were doing the night when the Liberty was attacked, the USS Liberty, attacked by Israeli airplanes, 40-some, I believe, I don't have the number exactly in my head, Americans killed, and Johnson orders their planes back to the aircraft carrier. There's no repercussion. Okay? This lady then went on to become the AIDS czar, the czarina. And the organization she founded, their great achievement, it's still on their website. I can't believe how stupid they are. But their great achievement is fast-tracking AZT.
Yes.
AZT is chemotherapy. AZT is what killed Robert Mapplethorpe.
Mm-hmm.
He was not in good shape to begin with, but this will kill you no matter what shape you're in. The difference between Magic Johnson and Arthur Ashe, these two athletes, is that Magic Johnson stopped taking AZT and Arthur Ashe took it until he died. That's what happened. And so then Matilda Krim has the chutzpah to show up at Mapplethorpe's funeral and tell the world what a great guy he was. And then she has the even more chutzpah to shake the Mapplethorpe Foundation down for money. $1 million or whatever I said in the figure that's in the... I can't believe this. I'm not making this up.
Yeah.
And then to top it all off, Bill Clinton gives her the Medal of Freedom Award. Well, this goes to show you what you need to do to be considered a Medal of Freedom Award. In addition to maybe pedophilia, which is how Led Zeppelin got the award,
mm-hmm.
you know, sleeping with 12-year-old girls, that's how they got the award. But this is what you need to do. This is how you're rewarded for service to the oligarchic evil empire.
Yeah, the AZT story, because that was a black-labeled chemotherapy drug that was shelved, and then along comes AIDS, and that becomes an excuse to sell it for a profit, and that's what they did with this AZT treatment. Of course, you allude to it in the book, the AIDS hypothesis, the HIV hypothesis, how it really doesn't have any legs to stand on. It's a syndrome. The collapse of the immune system is brought on by overuse of drugs, antibiotics, the lifestyle, just everything.
Right.
It's multiple factors, yeah.
It's not a virus. I went to Africa and gave lectures in Kenya about the non-existence of African AIDS. It just doesn't exist. In Africa, it's a birth control campaign. It's a way of getting Africans to use condoms.
Yep. And also, in Nancy Banks' book, AIDS, Diamonds, and Dr. Nancy Banks wrote a book, and she talks about it's that too. Yeah, it's also an excuse for more psychological warfare, because under the pretext as a public health measure, the schools started using very graphic sex ed programs targeting children.
Right.
It was used to sexualize children further.
Why did she show up there? I mean, I know it's chutzpah, but I mean, what was the message? Well, the message is, and she delivered it very clearly. After Dominic Dunn did his profile in Vanity Fair, you know, they changed the title of it and the message here is basically AIDS has nothing to do with homosexual behavior.
Well, that's fun, because they did the same thing with the church sex scandal, right? They made it the emphasis on pedophilia, not homosexuality.
Right.
At the same
right.
time, they're promoting homosexuality within the church. Because you get into Cardinal Bernardin and the church sex scandals and the profiteering by more Jewish attorneys on that scandal. Why are they promoting the very behavior which brought on the scandal?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the moral here is, why are we calling these people our elder brothers? I mean, I know the story of Cain and Abel. Is that what's behind this thing? You know? I mean, when is the church going to wake up to the fact that they have lost every single battle in the culture wars since 1965, when they inaugurated this failed campaign of Catholic-Jewish dialogue? This situation has been a catastrophe. And so the result is basically Newport, Kentucky is now family-friendly. They have an aquarium there. But Cincinnati is now Sin City.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you know it's Sin City?
Well, they have casinos there now.
Yeah, a casino. That's obvious. You're living in Sin City when you got a casino there. And it's not another Jew by the name of Dan Gilbert, who who is still the head of Quicken Loans. So he came by his money the usual Jewish way, usury, and now gambling. And now he can buy off the entire state of Ohio, basically. And so what you have here is it's called Jack now, the casino, $194 million sucked out of Cincinnati in 1 year. In 1 year. How is this in the interest of the people of Cincinnati? How is it that they tolerate this? How can this happen? Well, that's what the book is about. Mm-hmm. How did you get from the fact that George Raderman ran Mo Dalitz out of town to the fact that now Dan Gilbert is running Cincinnati? After they ran Mo Dalitz out of Newport, Kentucky, now Dan Gilbert runs Cincinnati. How do we get from there to there? Well, the answer is art. That's
mm-hmm. a simple. How do you reconcile sort of the Jewish influence is immense in this, but the influence of the Rockefellers and so the WASP establishment with modern art?
What 1978 was the year in which both John D. Rockefeller and Nelson Rockefeller died, mm-hmm. and it was like the changing of the guard. At that point, that was the end of the WASP ruling class.
I see. So, but yeah, after 67 into the 70s, you have the rise of the neocons, sort of the emergence, I think, in the overt appearance of Jewish power in the United States. Yeah,
right. And why it's not coincidence, because what happened in 65? The Jews broke the Hollywood production code. That meant they had free reign to basically mess with the American mind. And the first thing they did was get involved in pornography. First thing they did. Soon as the code, they broke the code with pornography. As of that definition, I'm talking about The Pawnbroker, which yep. is basically a Holocaust film with tits. This shows you how sacred the Holocaust is to Hollywood. They use this film, they use the Holocaust to smuggle bare breasts onto the movie screen.
Yes,
to break the production code.
And I remember about 40 years later, I just thought about this was. When they broadcast Schindler's List on network television, they showed nudity under the cover of a Holocaust movie.
Yeah,
and so it's a typical. Yeah, it's a repeat. They repeat that. Yeah, that strategy, that approach, because you can't criticize it. Even Howard Stern made a joke about that. By the way, I remember Howard Stern on his radio show, because he's always got in trouble for obscenity with his radio show, of course, and he just saw it as hypocritical that the federal government would allow this broadcast. He goes, "You want to show nudity and sex scenes on television? Just have a movie about killing Jews." Howard Stern said that. Howard Stern, I remember listening. Right. He said that.
Yeah, he got that one right.
And but you make this. I mean, this is. I mean, we're getting probably close to the end of our argument. I mean, our interview. And just this notion. You make this point about the '60s and the breaking of the production code, and where Hollywood was given free rein to wage psychological warfare on the American people. Particularly, the Catholic population in the United States became deracinated, was dispersed. You wrote about this in Slaughter of Cities, of course, and you get into economic warfare with Baron Metal, of course, Liber Dominandi too. You deal with the issue directly as sexual liberation as a political weapon. You point out the example in Ramallah, the Israelis broadcasting pornography to the Palestinians to beguile them and enslave them. So it's not liberation; it's slavery. The breaking, because earlier we talked about the Kennedys knowing this Catholic guy Roderman, because they're Catholic, they get his attention and they take action because of this Catholic identity. It wasn't just political; it was because the Kennedys were cultural Catholics despite their flaws. So what we're dealing with is in order to turn the tide, to turn this around, you need a development, you need to rebuild or a sense of. Of consciousness, of Catholic consciousness,
yes, you're
of
ethnic right. consciousness. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
So let's end on a positive note.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm down in Buenos Aires. I'm giving talks down there. I meet this guy, one of the representatives of the old patriarchy. He's fallen into despair, largely because of Bergoglio becoming pope. I said to him, I just got some good news. It's not as bad as you think. The day before I had gone to this estancia in the middle of Entre Rios, I got an email from Poland. And the guy wrote to me and he said, between the Polish translation of Libido Dominandi and the bishop's pastoral, the two of you have destroyed gender ideology in Poland. nobody in Poland takes gay marriage seriously anymore. Everybody now knows that it's a form of psychological warfare. Now, how did that happen? The answer is unity. Okay? When I was the first night, I'm in Warsaw. We're going to the cathedral where I'm going to give my first talk. The publisher is there, and the phone is ringing off the hook. Every minute, someone calls. The Jones has been denounced as an anti-Semite in one of the biggest newspapers in Poland. There are going to be massive demonstrations here and tomorrow in Wrocław. Cancel the talk. So I get there. I meet the chancellor. I go in. First of all, I have to say, I went in and prayed in the cathedral. Okay, come out of the cathedral, and there, as if in answer to my prayer, is the chancellor of the archdiocese, who comes up to me and says, "Don't worry. Don't worry. Give your talk. Everything's okay." I give my talk. There are people lined up around the block waiting to have me sign copies of their book. We go to Wrocław the next day, and there are 6 cop cars and no demonstrators. What did we have here? We had unity. We had Catholic unity. For once, the Catholics stuck together to maintain the moral and social order, and they won. We won in Poland. That's been a victory that's been obliterated. I said on Polish TV, anybody who proposes gay marriage should be immediately arrested as a traitor and put on trial as treason for betraying the Polish people. Well, that's pretty much the story now. They don't take it seriously. Anyone who starts promoting gay marriage is seen as a stooge of the oligarchs, of the international oligarchs or the Jews. Okay? It can happen, but it can only happen if we have unity in the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm. And that requires someone to identify as a Catholic and identify as a part of a Catholic, a particular parish and a community, because this gives us the, it gives Catholics the corporate representation and the tangible ability to organize to fight these people who are well organized. There's high level malevolence at play here. So people don't realize this is social engineering. It's psychological warfare planned at the highest levels of corporations, of government agencies, of the universities. Universities are just now, you know, diploma mills that are just predatory lending institutions that are designed to destroy your kids, to indoctrinate them, demoralize them. That's what they do. And what require to recognize all this stuff is requires first consciousness of it, and then the ability to identify with a particular group so you can organize and fight it, and fight it with love, and as you said, love, not fear. We're not looking for a Führer here.
No,
we don't need a Führer. That's
and
the
we
point.
Will diffuse. We will diffuse if we Catholics get to work on this. We will diffuse situations like the one we saw this weekend in Charlottesville.
Yeah,
deliberate, a deliberate provocation on the part of that city government.
Well, that's clear. A bunch of carpetbaggers and scallywags.
Racial warfare, and the man George Soros is the man who was given $34 million to Black Lives Matter to incite racial warfare in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a big fan of Donald Trump, but part of that press conference, I don't know if you saw it, addressing the idiotic members of the press. I mean, he just said there are two sides, they were fighting, and there are two sides of the story. Then he's talking about, the iconoclasm, destruction of these monuments in the South, which is a clear provocation to destroy Southern culture. They've been they've been targeted down there since the Leo Frank trilogy, as you write about. B'nai B'rith again, because B'nai B'rith are the ones that paid Malachi Markin, correct? Wasn't he a B'nai B'rith agent?
Absolutely. B'nai B'rith and the AJC, American Jewish Committee. So the big question about Charlottesville is, why weren't the cops between Antifa and the white guys? Why weren't they between them? Isn't that their job?
Yeah. One side had a permit. One side had a permit. The other side didn't. And they came in to start a fight. Yeah, it's obvious.
I'm saying that the way of Jesus Christ, this is not the way of Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
The Pope Benedict said, our models, it's not Simon Bar Kokhba, it's not Spartacus. You want that, then, there are other people. But this is the way of peace. And what I'm proposing is peace here. Peace.
And what's funny is, once you have consciousness, this stuff they use against you is completely, it's blunted. It has no effect on you because you recognize it's toxic.
That's what happened in Poland. Yeah. That's what happened in Poland. It can happen in Hungary. It can happen here.
Mm-hmm. So, well, Dr. Jones, I want to thank you. I think it would be a great talk tonight. That is Dr. E. Michael Jones, the editor of Culture Wars, and of course, the prolific writer. The book is How Meyer Lansky Took Over Cincinnati Ballet and What the Four Ballerinas Did About It. It's an ebook. You can also get it in paperback, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And,
go to Kindle. You can buy it on Kindle.
I got it on Kindle because it's easy to take notes on Kindle. And of course, your magazine is Culture Wars. You can go to culturewars.com and subscribe there. And of course, I always.
Culturewars.com. You can buy.
And if you really want to get in-depth understanding what we're talking about tonight, of course, you got to go read his books. The Jewish Revolutionary Spirit, Barren Metal, and, of course, most recent is the Broken Pump in Tanzania, Julius Nyerere, and the Collapse of Development Economics. Well, Dr. Jones, thank you. And I will wish you a good night.
My pleasure, Tim. Always a pleasure.
Good.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Barkers and the colored blues, and between.